Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. The Bible is banned in some Utah elementary and middle schools for vulgarity or violence. Records show that four GOP lawmakers pushed the UTA to remove a pride-themed bus. And congressmen tell the Supreme Court that Utahns have no right against partisan gerrymandering. Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. Courtney, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. We have with us as well reporter Jordan Miller. Jordan, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And State Watch reporter Emily Anderson-Stern joins us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Hi. Thanks thanks for coming on. And as always, news columnist Robert Gerke is with us. Thank you.
Hey, good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Let me start with Courtney Tanner. This is a very interesting case. The headline, Bible is banned in these Utah elementary and middle schools for vulgarity or violence. So where, which schools? I guess this is the Davis School District?
Right. So it's Davis School District. The Bible will stay on the shelves in high schools there, but it will be removed from elementary and middle schools. It's also worth noting that it's actually just the King James version of the Bible that's being removed. There are other versions that will actually stay on elementary and middle school shelves.
I love the beginning of your story. You say, in the beginning, a parent filed a challenge. You go on to say the district said, let there be a review of the book, and it was so. So, using biblical language. But let's go to even before that beginning with the law that was passed, right? Representative Ivory's bill.
Right. So Representative Ivory passed a bill in 2022, so not this most recent legislative session, but the one before that. And it essentially bans any books that contain pornographic or indecent content from Utah schools. And so that can include anything. I won't go into the examples, but anything that's, explicitly around sex. And it doesn't have to be reviewed as a whole. It's just taken off the shelves in those situations. But most districts have a review committee when a parent submits a complaint like this one on the Bible, for instance, to kind of look over the book and see the content.
So what was the legislature's concerns, like Representative Ivory's concerns here? What was driving this?
So there have been, both in Utah and nationwide, some conservative parent groups. So in Utah, it's Utah Parents United that have kind of pushed for certain books to be removed from school libraries. A lot of those books are around the LGBTQ plus community. Some of them are around race. So some folks feel like this is a targeted effort, but essentially, I guess kind of the big book that everyone would know would be like Gender Queer, which is a graphic novel that has raised some concerns for some of the illustrations within it. But it's essentially a book about the author's journey of self-identity. So essentially these conservative parent groups were concerned about what books were in libraries and kind of brought that to Representative Ivory's attention. And then he ran this bill to kind of create this process for reviewing those books and then removing them from shelves if they're found to be inappropriate.
So previous to the banning the Bible in a couple of these schools, had there been any books that had an appeal or had... parents voiced concerns over and went through this particular process?
Under this law, yeah, there have been hundreds actually since this law was passed in 2022 across the state that have been reviewed. There's 41 school districts here. Obviously, some school districts have seen more challenges than others. Davis School District in particular has seen a lot of challenges. Washington County School District down in southern Utah has seen a lot. Alpine School District in Utah County has seen some. So they're kind of spread out, but hundreds of book reviews since that law was passed, essentially.
Now, why did this parent suggest that the Bible be banned?
So this parent was actually frustrated by seeing all of those books being banned or challenged and felt that they were kind of targeted. So in their complaint that they had submitted to Davis School District, they kind of said, you know, if you're going to ban all of those books, then you might as well remove the Bible, which this parent described as the most sex-ridden book around. And then this parent submitted a list of, I think it was 8 pages of quotes from the Bible that, you know, dealt with bestiality, sexuality, et cetera, that they found concerning.
So the school board appointed a committee, right? And the committee is who ruled on this.
That's right. So that's kind of the process that the law sets out. And so they have a review committee that's made up of parents, and the parents review the challenges. And so in this case, the committee reviewed the Bible and decided that they felt that it was fine in high schools, but that it had too much vulgarity or violence for elementary and middle schools, which is important to know that that's not actually, I mean, the law itself is about pornography or indecent content. And so they didn't find that it violated the law, which is why it's allowed to stay on shelves in the high school. But there's a caveat in the law that also allows districts to say if they think it's inappropriate based on age, which is part of the law that they ruled on to not have it in elementary and middle schools.
So the words the committee used, vulgarity or violence.
Right.
Yeah. And the Bible will remain in high schools, I guess, in Davis County.
Right. Yeah. So it'll be removed from the elementary and middle schools. Although, again, it's just the King James version because that's what was challenged in this complaint. So there's actually other versions of the Bible that will remain in middle school and elementary schools unless someone decides to challenge those too.
Did the committee speak on that? Yeah, I found that interesting. Only the King James version is banned, not the other versions of the Bible.
Right. And the committee hasn't spoken publicly. Just the district has, you know, released statements on this. But essentially, they've said because the King James version of the Bible is the only one that was challenged, it's the only one that the committee reviewed. So they kind of limited their review to what was in the specific complaint.
What about other religious books, the Torah, Quran, Book of Mormon?
Yes, that's been an interesting development in this. So when the news broke that the Bible had been banned, a parent on last Friday, so a week ago, filed a complaint against the Book of Mormon. So now that's under review in Davis School District 2. The Quran has not been challenged. So we're kind of waiting, I guess, to see if other religious texts are. But so far, it's, you know, this Bible ban and then the Book of Mormon. But the Bible ban is also being appealed too. So that decision could change, I guess.
So what is that process? Where is it appealed to?
Yeah. So the district then forms a committee of three members that are part of its Board of Education. So this is a new committee, and then they review the appeal, and then they make a recommendation to the full school board, and then during a public meeting, that full board will make a final decision to either, like, stick with the original ban or to do something different because of the appeal.
So for the Book of Mormon, is that a different committee, or is that the original committee?
It'll be a different committee. So every book complaint actually has its own committee, and it's made up of parents, and it's kind of a random selection of parents on this list that have volunteered to be on these review committees. So yeah, they'll form a new committee now to look at the Book of Mormon, and that process will start from the beginning.
And again, what are the complaints against the Book of Mormon?
That one's mostly centered around violence. We have a records request in to see the full complaint, but a Book of Mormon doesn't have so much like sexuality in it. It's more like beheadings and fights. So violence mostly.
You have a separate story. We're talking with reporter Courtney Tanner from Salt Lake Tribune about the Bible being banned in some schools in Davis County. So Representative Ken Ivory, I guess initially he's using words, this parent's challenge to the Bible, use words like mockery and political stunt, but then he changed his mind.
Yeah, he posted a pretty lengthy statement on his Facebook account last week, kind of reversing course, essentially saying that now he agrees with the Bible being banned in elementary and middle schools under this Davis School District, you know, decision. Ivory's the one who wrote the law essentially about parents being able to request the removal of books. And now he's saying that, you know, the Bible is a quote challenging read for younger kids, and he feels that it's best if they read it at home. So he's fine with it.
But he's calling for something else, I think, right? A pretty broad review.
Yes. He'd also like all school districts to review all their instructional materials, which is a huge request. It's kind of unclear how that would be done, and what all that would include. But if you talk about instructional materials, I mean, that's worksheets, assignments, books, I mean, anything you can really think of. So it'd be kind of a monumental task. We'll see if that moves forward. State lawmakers have actually previously tried to mandate kind of a public approval process for curriculum, and that didn't pass. That bill didn't go anywhere.
So that's his suggestion is not mandated by law at this point, right? It's just a
Right, yeah.
suggestion that they
Just a
review.
suggestion to maybe look at drafting something.
So again, I think it's good to emphasize that the law seemed to target pornographic materials, or what the law would now define as pornographic or indecent.
Right, that was his intention behind the law, and to see that things were like age appropriate for children. So yeah, I mean, he uses like he's created his own hashtag, which is hashtag safe, not sexualized Utah schools. So he's very much interested in not having books that discuss like sexuality in schools.
What is Utah Parents United saying? This is the group that's been pushing for book bannings, right?
Yeah, so they released a statement essentially saying, you know, that they feel like they're being targeted by this challenge of the Bible, that essentially that they feel like it's was only submitted because of them. But they say that they don't think that it should be banned. They think it's age appropriate. And they kind of reiterate essentially like what they think that they've been trying to do in removing books. And you know, they support their work obviously in trying to remove books from school libraries that they find inappropriate.
Now, obviously, other parents are concerned about banning books.
Right. There's definitely this has been an interesting kind of tug of war. So you know, you've got Utah Parents United and conservative parents on one side saying, you know, we don't want these explicit books, or what they call explicit books. It's really up for debate, I think, in school libraries. And then you've got parents on the other side saying, you know, if you don't want those books, then don't have your kids check them out, but they want them available for their own kids to check out if they want. And they worry that the bans are kind of targeting LGBTQ plus or books by authors of color, and they see it as censorship.
In the meantime, I'm reading Brian Schott's story from this week. There was a news conference. Religious leaders, Republican lawmakers, Utah State Board of Education member were there in support of this process, in support of banning, but not the Bible, they're saying.
Right. Yeah, it was kind of an interesting group of people that came together, kind of led by the Utah Eagle Forum. But yeah, I mean, you've got religious leaders that are saying that the Bible is this, you know, important text that they don't want to see banned in any way, shape, or form. And again, there's an appeal of the Bible ban that says the same thing, where a parent says, you know, this shouldn't be banned from elementary and middle schools. This should be available to all students. And so I think that's kind of where that group's coming from, is saying, you know, keep the Bible on the shelves. You're using the law in the wrong way.
And I may have mischaracterized. I don't know that I have evidence from Brunshot's story that these folks were or are in support of book banning. Maybe they are, but their message was don't ban the Bible.
Right, exactly.
So I guess some of these folks are saying that they're a little concerned that they haven't heard from the board. They've only heard from the committee appointed by the board.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting comment, because the law sets out the review committee. So that's kind of how the process is supposed to go. Obviously, with the Bible ban now being appealed, they will hear from the board, because the board will have to make the final decision on that appeal. So there will be a decision coming from the board, but technically the process set out by the law just has the review committee on it.
Courtney Tanner, you have another interesting story. I want to spend just a couple of minutes on that. You attended a high school graduation at the Utah State Prison. Before we get there, I want to get Robert Gerke's take on this whole book banning and the banning of the Bible.
I mean, it's a little ironic to see these same legislators who are, you know, clamoring to have all of these books pulled off shelves, you know, claiming that this is about parental control and parents being able to decide what books are in their libraries, and then turning around when there's one that they don't want banned gets pulled off the shelves, and saying that they're you know, doing it wrong. It's they want to have it both ways, and it's, you know, I mean, I think anybody, as the editorial board wrote this week, I think anybody could have seen this coming, that this was going to end up going down this path. You know, I don't have a problem with the Bible being pulled out of elementary schools. Frankly, it's not something that I think most elementary schools kids are going to read. But also, you know, in this state, when it comes to junior high and high schools, we have the seminary program where LDS kids get time to go study these texts in a supervised manner. And I think that's, you know, perfectly fine. I'm not generally in favor of banning books. And mostly, as Courtney noted, this has been a ploy to try to remove books that deal with LGBTQ issues or racial issues. Rather, you know, under the pretext of you know, them being inappropriate. So I think, you know, I think this, whenever we go down this road, I think you get into some, you know, some sticky issues. And, you know, the legislature, as it often does, is going to exercise all of, you know, is going to use its power to dictate to local districts, you know, and local parents, what their kids can and can't have access to, despite, it appears, the parents' wishes that in this case, they don't think the kids should have access to it.
Well, thanks, Robert. So Courtney, I just want to talk briefly about this story. You know, heartwarming story. This is a high school graduation ceremony at the Utah State Prison. The first ceremony, I think, at the new location, right?
That's right. Yeah, it was really heartwarming, like you said, to get to be there and see that and see the excitement.
Kind of a smaller number, you report. That's, I guess, what, because of the relocation and because of COVID? Is that the?
Yeah, it's been a tricky little bit, but there were 38 inmates who got high school diplomas on Monday. But yeah, COVID has kind of challenged that a little bit, because obviously there was a time where they couldn't take in-person classes. And then there was this transfer from the Draper facility to the new facility that's out by the Salt Lake Airport.
So what were some of the inmates saying about this?
Yeah, it was pretty powerful. I recommend you go read the story, not because I wrote it, but because it's kind of powerful to read. But, you know, there were these inmates that were talking about how now that they have a high school diploma, they hope, you know, to use that. So like one woman wants to use her diploma to help her kids with their homework when she gets out. And she realized that to be successful when she is released in a month, that she needed to graduate, you know. And others talked about how, you know, working through the classes and, you know, putting themselves through this to work hard, you know, taught them something. And, you know, they said it's given them an opportunity to improve their lives and be better people. And it was pretty powerful to see that, you know, and obviously these are people that are in prison for a reason, but they want to use this to change their lives and motivate them to do better.
And not only you know, family members, but the teachers were sitting there wiping away tears as well.
Yeah, I admit I was wiping away a few too. But yeah, there was this row of teachers that was sitting in front of me that, you know, was passing around a box of tissues, and there was family on the other side that'd come to see these individuals get their diplomas. You know, some of these individuals have been in prison since they were teens, and so they didn't have a high school, you know, graduation ceremony where they walked across the stage or they dropped out of high school. And so this was kind of this big moment for these families.
So I think the, I guess, point of the program is to help reduce recidivism, better transition back into society, I guess a couple of reasons.
Right. And that's, yeah, a really good thing to point out. So of the 38 inmates that graduated, 14 of them are actually repeat offenders. So it's not their first time in jail. And the hope with getting these diplomas is that when they are released again, that they won't come back here, you know, that this will help them kind of transition into society, get jobs, you know, and not reoffend.
There's higher education as well, I think.
there are higher education options in the prison. One of the students that graduated is actually enrolling in that this fall with the program through Salt Lake Community College. There's also like trade certificate offerings there. There's quite a few opportunities.
One of the inmates said, even though I received my education in prison, I'll make a difference outside of prison. So that's very, very hopeful for these inmates. Well, Courtney Tanner, thanks for reporting on that. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And hope you'll stay for the end of the program and your underplayed story of the week. Robert Gerke, anything you want to say on this education program in the prison?
Not a lot. I mean, I think these programs are so important, though, for people who to build their lives on the outside and sort of get things back together. I mean, if you've been in prison and then you get out and you don't have the tools to find a good job, your likelihood of ending up back there is much higher. And so, you know, it's making the best of a bad situation and changing lives and trying to help rebuild them.
Well, coming up following a break, we're going to be talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Jordan Miller. The headline there, records show that four GOP lawmakers pushed the UTA to remove a Pride-themed bus. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. More following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. The next headline we're going to take a look at is records show that four GOP lawmakers pushed UTA to remove a Pride-themed bus. And we bring in Salt Lake Tribune reporter Jordan Miller. Jordan, thanks.
Hi, yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So interesting story. So I guess maybe a starting point would be that we've all seen this, right? The buses, not only in Salt Lake area, but up in here in Logan, where I'm at, probably around the state. They take advantage of all that space, you know, that surface area to put advertising and such on there. I didn't know this until I read your story. I guess that's called livery.
Yes, livery. I think it's kind of a term for, like, if you've ever watched Downton Abbey, they talk about livery, like the outfit. So, yes.
Right. The bus in question, tell us about that, the livery that was on this bus.
Yeah, so this bus has been in service for, I think, over a year, per the spokesperson I spoke with at UTA. And it has a rainbow progress pride wrapping. And it says work with pride on the front or on the side of it. And it was supposed to appear in the pride parade last week. And on Friday, we were able to confirm that the bus was replaced with one of UTA's electric buses, like a different bus that didn't have the pride wrapping on it. And whenever I reached out to figure out the reason for the switch, they had told me that it was to kind of showcase the electric buses just to kind of promote clean energy in front of the huge crowds that the Pride Parade has. But the decision was made fairly quickly. So it was just like 2 days, I think, after they had showcased the Pride bus on there, just a few days after they'd showcased the Pride bus on a Twitter post. So yeah, it was a rainbow Pride themed bus. It got replaced with an electric bus. They had explained that it was replaced to showcase the clean energy that UTA wants to promote. And whenever I requested some records, it provided a little bit more light on the situation, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I guess one of the mysteries here was that I think of this tweet or otherwise UTA said, hey, you know, look for the Pride wrapped bus in the Pride parade. And then that didn't happen, right?
Yeah, it said keep an eye out for the Pride wrapped bus on our system. And so it really made it seem like they were going to have the bus featured in some kind of position this week. And whenever I spoke with them, they confirmed that was the original bus that was supposed to be in the parade, but it got replaced with the electric bus.
So it did open records request. What did you find from those records?
Those records showed four GOP lawmakers had sent texts to UTA describing their displeasure with the wrapping, kind of saying that they felt that it was inappropriate for taxpayer funds to go towards something like this. And however, the wrapping, which has been on a bus for over a year, was not funded by any taxpayer money. It was privately donated from R&R Advertising and Lamar Advertising per a spokesperson. So there's a little bit of a, I guess, miscommunication or misunderstanding there of exactly how this Pride-themed bus came along, and it's been in service for over a year. So some of the representatives that I spoke with, like Representative Hayes, really felt that if that was really a taxpayer issue, it would have been addressed whenever this bus first came on the street.
So these lawmakers who objected, even though it was privately funded, I think they're stressing UTA is, they're saying it's a state entity, or it's a government entity, and so that's where the heartburn came.
Yeah, in particular, Representative Mike Schultz, the House Majority Leader, talked to a UTA board member and explained that the Twitter post was causing a whole bunch of drama inside the caucus, and that was the same day that this bus was showcased on their Twitter. And he asked if it was really necessary and if the UTA could reevaluate its decision. And he pushed forth and said that since they were a state-owned entity and whoever made the decision to move forward with this bus, quote, knew it would be controversial. So they were really pushing that this bus was not appropriate in many ways. And another representative spoke about how they felt that the UTA should be focusing on its mission of getting people to point A to point B. And just a lot of people were really concerned about the message, I guess, it would send. And yeah, it was just a lot of lawmakers reached out to express their concerns with this wrapping the day on its posting on their Twitter or the day after.
So one of these was Representative Schultz, right? He's the majority leader. I want to quote from your story from the records that you got. Representative Schultz said, to quote the speaker, and I guess he's at least maintaining that he's quoting the speaker, Speaker Wilson here, we live in Utah, we shouldn't have to deal with this stuff. What does the speaker say?
Yeah, whenever we reached out, or in the continued text of that, he explained that he had a group of members wanting UTA to make a formal public apology, and that they just wanted the problem solved as soon as possible so that they didn't have to go down this road. And it basically, whenever we reached out to House Speaker Brad Wilson, he had also said that Utah has big opportunities to embrace and big challenges to overcome, and that he was hopeful UTA would stick to its core mission of moving Utahns. So I guess there's still a bit of unclear murkiness around what exactly they were referring to, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. You quoted Representative Hayes, Sarah Hayes, Democrat from Salt Lake City, the only openly LGBTQ plus state lawmaker, right? And Representative Hayes had quite a bit to say about representation, that this, I guess, from the representative's perspective, positive representation that this livery had or would have had.
Yeah. She spoke a lot about how looking at rainbow flags and just Pride liveries, things of that nature, show that she and her partner can be safe walking into an establishment, that she doesn't have to check whether or not they can hold hands. And it just provides kind of a message that LGBTQ people are welcomed and accepted. And she explained that she really felt it was disheartening to see that this message of hope, inclusion, and acceptance was vilified by elected leaders.
And she goes on to say that it feels like a government microaggression. That's one statement she said.
Yeah, exactly. She talked a little bit about how when we're passing laws that target people's ability to live their lives and tacking messages of hope and acceptance, it was just really disappointing to the LGBTQ community to kind of see things like that. And she also mentioned that Governor Cox's Pride Month declaration did not include the phrase LGBTQ. And it just, she did say that it felt like a lot of government microaggressions towards the community, in addition to high level things like SB 16 and the banning of care.
Has Governor Cox weighed in on this?
No, we reached out to his office, but they did not immediately respond to a request for comment.
What about UTA? What is UTA saying about this?
Yeah, UTA said in a statement on Tuesday that it remains committed to supporting its diverse communities and listening to community partners. And I don't know if you saw, but Executive Director of UTA, Jay Fox, penned an opinion piece for the Tribune kind of talking about the situation. And he really felt like a lot was lost in translation, kind of about the tool for UTA to promote transit and then also just symbolize inclusion in the greater community and the state that UTA serves. So there's a lot more in his opinion piece on the Tribune, and there's more in the statement that I cited in the story.
Yeah, we'll do. We'll direct you to that, sltrib.com. In the meantime, did I read this right? That bus with the livery is out of service?
Yeah, the future for that bus is really unclear. There's some further reporting I'm trying to chase to kind of figure out if the Pride wrapping is going to be removed, if the Pride bus is still going to be in service as it has been for over a year now. But it's really unclear what the future is for that bus. But there are more records that I've requested that I should be getting soon. So keep an eye out on that front.
All right. We'll look for that reporting from Jordan Miller. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I hope you stay tuned or stay with us for another few minutes to give us your underplayed story of the week. So news columnist Robert Gerke, what are your thoughts on this?
You know, it's a really unfortunate situation, I think, because Pride in and of itself does not need to be a political event. It's, supporting members of our community. Is not a political act, but it gets politicized by these right-wing Republicans who can't seem to wrap their heads around the idea of people in among us being different and accepting that. It's a really unfortunate situation. It also kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier with the book banning. It's just another example of the legislature overreaching and using too much abusing the power that they've given themselves. I mean, I think Jay Fox's editorial in the paper kind of talks about their motivation and their intent in doing this, but it also, they were in a position where they didn't have a whole lot of choice but to capitulate and take the bus out of circulation. And, while I agree with the idea that this is a not just a microaggression, it's an aggression, because while having the Pride wrapped bus maybe send a affirming message, taking it out of circulation in such a obvious public facing manner, I think it sends a really strong message about the lack of acceptance and the dismissiveness and the rejection of the entire community by the legislature. It's really unfortunate. And, but this is where our Utah legislature clearly is. And it sends a clear signal of what they think about an entire segment of our community.
We'll head toward a break now. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCBW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. Following break, we're going to turn to this headline. Congressmen tell the Supreme Court the Utahns have no right against partisan gerrymandering. We'll be talking with State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm UPR's Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So for this story, I think we probably ought to start with a little background. People may or may not know. So let's go back to the Better Boundaries getting an initiative on the ballot. I'm not sure what year that was, and it passed narrowly, but it passed, right?
Right. It passed in 2018. Just over 50% of Utahns voted for that. Of Utahns who voted for that.
And what did that initiative set up?
So that initiative set up an independent redistricting commission to essentially look at the fairest way to draw voting boundaries in the state. And so they came up with some maps. They, talked to members of the public. And they put those, they propose those maps to the legislature, and the legislature then it went through its own process. They talked to members of the public too, and they drew up their own maps. But a lot of people came to public comment meetings on those maps and said these maps are nothing like the Independent Redistricting Commission's maps, and these ones, from a lot of people's perspective, clearly benefited Republicans.
I guess the biggest change maybe was the 4th District, right, which became more Republican, looks like.
Right. And you can see some of that difference in the results of the 2022 election. In 2020, Burgess Owens beat Ben McAdams just by 1 percentage point. But that margin was much larger in 2022 when Burgess Owens beat Darlene McDonald by, you know, a lot more. I think it was something like 30 percentage points.
According to your story, a group of Utahns and voter rights groups then suing the legislature and Utah election officials. Tell me about that suit.
Yeah, so that lawsuit alleges that, you know, that there are several complaints that they initially brought in that lawsuit. Among them are that these districts are a case of illegal partisan gerrymandering. And also, you know, that it was illegal for the legislature to ignore what the Independent Redistricting Commission came up with, the commission that was set up after Utah voters approved that ballot initiative that you mentioned.
And the four congressmen were subpoenaed. Or why were they subpoenaed?
So they were subpoenaed in December, and a lot of people, you know, knew about these subpoenas, but at the time, it wasn't entirely clear what was in them. You know, the congressmen haven't really talked about them. And at the time, the attorneys for the plaintiffs wouldn't provide the subpoenas. But I was talking to one of the attorneys while I was working on this story. And he said they were seeking the congressmen's communications with state lawmakers about how their own district boundaries should be drawn.
So that's an important point. I don't know. It is... seems like that might be problematic, the legislature conferring with sitting congressmen about how their own district should be drawn. I don't know if that's illegal.
Yeah, and we don't know, you know, what kind of communications they may have had, or if they, you know, asked to be part of that process, because the lawmakers actually did not respond to the subpoenas. They did not cooperate in that process, according to the attorney I spoke to. And, you know, they didn't respond to my questions when I reached out to them about the subpoenas. The plaintiffs couldn't force the congressman to answer those subpoenas because in January, the case was stayed while a motion from the state to dismiss the case is considered by, or an appeal to dismiss the case is considered by the Utah Supreme Court.
So this is at the Utah Supreme Court. So according to your reporting, there was a brief quietly submitted to the Utah Supreme Court by the four congressmen. What are they asking? What are they saying in this brief?
So this brief, you know, it makes a couple of key arguments. One of those is that, you know, it essentially draws upon the fringe independent state legislature theory, which essentially asserts that state lawmakers have the sole authority to regulate federal elections, specifically in this case. And the only people who can interfere with, you know, the maps that they draw, if those are considered inappropriate or gerrymandered, are Congress. And so, you know, the congressmen are arguing that for a state court to intervene, it's taking away from powers that they say they have based on Article 1, Section 4 of the U.S. Constitution, commonly called the Elections Clause. And then they're also arguing that there's no right against partisan gerrymandering within the U.S. Constitution. And Utah's Constitution doesn't explicitly bar partisan gerrymandering either. So, you know, there's really not a problem, or there's no basis for the courts to strike down these maps is what they're saying. So the lawsuit should be thrown out.
And what are they saying? What is the remedy, do they think, if a voter is concerned that his or her vote has been essentially gerrymandered and watered down?
Well, they said that, you know, if people don't want partisan gerrymandering, there has to be, in the brief, they say there has to be political will. That will, for the state to adopt anti-gerrymandering laws, and that will must come from the people of Utah and their elected representatives. So essentially, you know, if people are upset that they don't have these anti-partisan gerrymandering laws, then they should elect new representatives to put those laws in place.
Yeah. In the meantime, we don't know how the Utah Supreme Court is going to rule. Do we have some tea leaves we can read? I think there are some other cases around the country.
Yeah. So one case to watch that would have probably a big impact on this particular case is one coming out of North Carolina that's in front of the Supreme Court right now. And it's Moore v. Harper. And that also, you know, gets into the independent state legislature theory. So whatever the Supreme Court says about that could impact this case as far as, you know, does a state legislature have the ultimate authority to decide what election maps look like?
Yeah, so I guess we'll find out. To conclude here, what's the timeline? Do we think when do we think the Supreme Court will take the next action?
So the next hearing is scheduled for July 11th, and in that hearing, the justices will hear arguments from both parties as to whether or not they should throw this case out, and also another appeal. A district court judge who refused to throw the case out. She dismissed the part of the complaint that's, you know, where plaintiffs said it was illegal for the legislature to essentially ignore Proposition 4, ignore the Independent Redistricting Commission. And so the plaintiffs are also appealing that and asking the Supreme Court to tack that back onto the case. So we'll hear arguments on that in July. And then attorneys for the plaintiffs are estimating that it'll probably take, you know, maybe a few months to hear back from the Supreme Court on where they fall on those appeals. You know, the plaintiffs are hoping that the case will be resolved by the end of the year, but probably not before the second congressional district election in which Representative Chris Stewart will be replaced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Emily Anderson Stern, thanks so much for telling us about this.
Thanks, Tom.
We'll get Robert's thoughts on this. And if we have time, I want to come back and talk briefly about another story that you had. Robert Gerke, I happen to know you have thoughts on this because you wrote a column on this.
Yeah. Yeah. I was pretty shocked. Well, I guess I shouldn't say I was shocked because we've seen, right-wing groups advocating this fringe theory of the independent legislature in cases all across the country. But I think it is worthwhile to kind of take a step back and say, okay, if they really believe that, you know, Utah citizens don't have a right to vote in a free and fair election, then what does that say about their views of democracy? Because it's fundamental to our entire American, you know, democratic republic to have this vote as the underpinning of you know, of a representative democracy. And if they believe that it's not something that people are entitled to, I think it says a lot about how they view their constituents and how they view the entire democratic process. It's really hard to believe that the founders who set up this system of checks and balances didn't think that the courts should be able to review this and that legislatures should be able to rig elections any way they want. If we're going down that road, it's pretty frightening. I mean, you get to a situation where you have a North Korea style government where the power is, you know, it belongs to whoever it has the ability to set the rules. And so it's a disturbing viewpoint, I think, from people who are supposed to be elected to represent their constituents, to have such disdain for their constituents' voice and not fight to protect that voice. So fortunately, I don't think it's going to have much influence, any influence really, on the outcome of this election, because they're not actually parties to the litigation. But I think from the perspective of look inside the mind of the people who are supposed to be representing us, it's a disturbing scene.
Emily Anderson Stern, I wonder if we could get about the one-minute version of your other story here. The headline is Human Rights Campaign declares a state of emergency for LGBTQ plus people. This is nationwide, I think. First of all, what's the Human Rights Campaign?
So the Human Rights Campaign is an LGBTQ plus advocacy group. And, you know, they look a lot at, you know, when LGBTQ plus folks when their rights are violated. In this particular, the state of emergency comes as a slew of anti-LGBTQ plus laws has been passed in state legislatures throughout the country. And so as part of that, they put out a guide. So the LGBTQ plus people, as they're traveling or considering moving from state to state, how they can see how laws in those states might impact them. And, you know, on the guidebook, there are a few laws in Utah that it talks about. There is a good law as far as the conversion therapy ban here. And it also notes that Utah does have a non-discrimination law for LGBTQ plus people, but that law is partial. It doesn't protect LGBTQ plus people in places of public accommodation. But Utah also, you know, received some bad marks in other categories, specifically for laws that target young people, young LGBTQ plus people in the state. So those include, you know, a gender affirming care ban for transgender youth that was passed this last year, and also a sports participation ban for transgender kids that is currently on hold while it's challenged in court. So we'll see what happens to that. But, you know, there are several other types of laws that other states with majority GOP legislatures have passed that Utah doesn't have, including, you know, a bathroom ban, an LGBTQ plus erasure law, a don't say LGBTQ plus law, pronoun refusal law, forced student outing law, and a statewide anti-drag ban. But the caveat there is that Utah has considered several of those laws, and some of them were amended before they were passed to not quite be as harsh as some of the other laws in other Republican majority states. And some of them, you know, were amended, and then the legislature didn't like the bill anymore, so they weren't voted on or they didn't pass.
Well, thank you for telling us about that extra story there. You can find that at sltrib.com. So it's time to go to our underplayed stories of the week here at the end of the program. We'll start with Courtney Tanner. Courtney, what's your underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, I love being first. I'm going to pick a story from Eric Walden that kind of dissects the Utah Jazz and who they could trade for in the future. If you are a Jazz fan, it is an incredibly fun read, so I would recommend that.
You can find that at sltrib.com. Thank you. So next up, Jordan Miller, what is your underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, my colleague Palak Jaiswal has been working really hard on this story that came out this week on trans teens and what's happened since the Utah legislature banned care. So it goes through a few perspectives on what challenges a few teens have faced since that legislation has come through. So I really recommend that.
All right. You can find that at sltrib.com. Emily Anderson Stern, what's your underplayed story of the week?
I second Jordan on that. That's a great story. But also another one that I loved this week was one from Sophia Jeremias about the Daybreak community out in South Jordan and how it's become, you know, what is called in the headline a cycling oasis. It's not a car-centric community, very walkable, bikeable. And then talks about, you know, some of the challenges that greater society poses to those types of communities and making suburban communities so bikeable and walkable for the folks who live there.
Wonderful. Robert Gerke, what's your underplayed story of the week?
All of those three were great. Mine is a little bit more of a procedural story, I guess, but Leah Larson had a piece that is noting that the comments period is open for this Parley's gravel pit, the gravel mine that we've talked about in the past on the show. The public has until July 27th to weigh in for or against that proposed mine. And so the story explains how people can comment, how people can make their views known, and you know, talk to some people who are trying to drum up opposition to the proposed mine.
And you can find that at sltrib.com. I'll choose a story from Brian Schott. Leaders of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints warned that straight party voting is a threat to democracy. Gordon Monson had a piece on this as well. You can find those at sltrib.com. Robert Gerke, we have about 30 seconds. I just wanted to highlight your column, I think, from this morning, where you note that the special election dates have been set for the Representative Stewart's replacement, And you're urging people to whatever party to register as Republicans so you can have a voice in this.
Right. Because, as you know, as we talked about, these districts have been gerrymandered to the point that the general election is not likely to be super competitive. And so the best way that people can actually have some influence on the outcome of this, I think, is to register as a Republican, whether they share Republican views or not, and vote in that primary election. But it's going to be a crowded field. And so, you know, a small number of votes could make a big difference. Plus, I'm sorry, I just lost my train of thought.
Oh, sorry. We'll have to end it right there anyway, out of time. But yeah, do read that column, Robert Kirky's column, and all the rest at sltrib.com. We've had with us in the program Courtney Tanner, along with Jordan Miller, Emily Anderson Stern, and Robert Kirky. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. And thanks for listening to Behind the Headlines.